We've been forced to think about racism a lot in the last few years. Everything from the election of Barack Obama to police shootings to the primary victories of Donald Trump raises the issue of how people with black skin and white skin interact, and in many cases just don't. Our guest this hour had his own experiences with racism, his own racism. Jim Grimsley grew up in the South in the 1960s when schools began to be integrated. His book on what the time was like and what he was like is How I Shed My Skin, Unlearning the Racist Lessons of a Southern Childhood. Jim Grimsley is well known as a novelist, the author of Winter Birds and Dream Boy and two other books. He still lives in the South, working in Atlanta and teaching at Emory University. Jim Grimsley, thanks for joining us on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thanks for having me. It's really a great pleasure to be here.
You write, "While these years of my life are distant, they remain vivid and present in my mind." Was this a book you really had to write?
Yes, it really. I started thinking about this book some 20-odd years ago. I wasn't really prepared to tackle it until about 6 years ago when I started trying to remember, started to write my memories down. I wrote a version of this as a novel that didn't work. Mostly because what I really needed to tell was my own story, to tell a true story, a real story, the story of how the years of school integration in North Carolina showed to me that I had been raised with a good deal of bigotry that I had already internalized, and over the next few years encountering black people really for the first time directly, I came to understand that I was a bigot and that I needed to change.
Well, if you had written this as a novel, I mean, you certainly could have fictionalized your own parts in here. But I get the sense that writing How I Shed My Skin was a bit like tearing off a mask and maybe a large Band-Aid at the same time.
Yeah, I think that's a pretty good description of it. I had been dealing with this stuff in my personal life, of course, since those days. My high school years, late elementary school and high school years, were all a matter of seeing that I had been raised to believe one set of facts about black people and then being confronted with black people and realizing that none of the prejudice that I'd actually been taught was true. Coming to this material as an adult, though, was a bit like tearing off a Band-Aid because I was forced to go back into the racist self that I had abandoned. I don't believe you ever really lose the kind of racism that was taught to me and that I internalized at a young age, but you learn how to deal with it and you learn to put it aside in your thinking and in your daily life. But in the course of writing the book, I had to explore the stuff that was in my head in those days, and that wasn't really very pleasant, but it was necessary.
I can imagine this is almost like looking at a high school yearbook, and everybody giggles at the pictures of themselves, but this is looking at your inside and having one of those reactions.
Yeah, pretty much. I did, in fact, have to get my high school yearbook out and stare at it for quite a bit. I mean, these memories are some 50 years old in some cases, and that, while I'm very confident at this point, very confident indeed in what I've written, since so many of my friends from that era have read the book and have confirmed a lot of the things that I went through and that I remembered, I still had the process of recovering all that memory and trying to make a piece of. In the book, I'm actually trying to recreate myself as a child and to use the techniques of a novelist to put the reader inside my head and in some cases to walk the reader through the story moment by moment as I'm you know encountering the black girls, for instance, who came to my sixth grade class, what that day was like, what that year was like. So I really did have to do the best that I could to remember all the details, all the physical details of the era.
You get a lot of good stuff in there. We're talking about Jones County, North Carolina, eastern North Carolina, which you describe alternately as a community of closeness and caring and at the same time pettiness and imperfections. I mean, how much is your fondness for the place challenged by the unpleasant things that you came to know about it as you grew older?
I guess what I'd say is there's no place that's any worse than that I can think of, but no place that's better either. The kind of flaws that I detected in the people that I grew up with were part of at least Southern human nature in those days, and most likely the racism that I learned in my community there, while it was influenced by the Jim Crow laws that were in effect at the time and influenced by the dual school systems. I don't think that, you know, it's important to remember that segregation wasn't unique just to the states of the old Confederacy. I think over half of the states in the country had segregated school systems at that time. So everybody, I think, in that era was taught a certain degree of white supremacy, if not overt racism. And so in that way, I think this story is something that a lot of people could find some value in.
Help people not from the South understand the organization of a town like Pollocksville. Was there really essentially two towns living together in within one set of city limits?
That's a very good description of it. Not just within the city limits either. Unless you live through this time, you don't understand the fact that the social segregation that was imposed on black people and white people was more or less total. I mean, Pollocksville is a town of about 450 people. It's tiny. So that the black people who lived in town were, in effect, they were my neighbors. They were people who lived one street over from us. Sometimes they lived next door. I mean, if you read the book, in one of the houses we lived in, there was a house right behind ours that had a black lady living in it. But we didn't interact at all until integration came along.
All right, much more to talk about with Jim Grimsley. His book is How I Shed My Skin, Unlearning the Racist Lessons of a Southern Childhood. Back on the Exchange to talk with Jim and you by phone and by email if you'd like to join us in a minute 15. You're back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking to Jim Grimsley, who's known as a novelist, primarily the author of Winter Birds and Dream Boy and two other novels, well regarded. He is also the author of a memoir about his own time growing up in the racist South of the 1960s as a white person and dealing with his own feelings about black people as his school integrated. The book, now out in paperback, is called How I Shed My Skin, Unlearning the Racist Lessons of a Southern Childhood. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange with perhaps your own memories, your own experiences on either side of this divide. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So you mentioned that sometimes the black families actually lived fairly close to you, but by age 11, Jim, how many black people did you know by name or conversation?
I knew a couple by reputation. When we... At 11 years old, that's when schools integrated, so that's the time at which I started to know black children by name. Before that, I knew a woman who lived behind our house. I think her name was Miss Dinah. I can't remember exactly what the name was. And I changed all the names in the book, of course. But she was probably the only black person I did know by name. I also knew the shoe repair man, but I never did know his name. So it was in the sixth grade when three girls integrated my all-white classroom. There were 30-odd students in the classroom, and we'd all been in the same room together since we were in the first grade, and then these three black girls came into the class that year and sort of broke open the world for all of us. The kids in the class basically had to decide how we were going to treat those girls, whether we were going to actually feel them as other children, as equals to us, or whether we were going to sort of close our eyes and pretend that all the myths that we'd heard about black people were true.
You know, I spent enough time in the South, and my wife grew up there, that I'm aware of some of the mores. You don't talk about a lot of things overtly. We're talking 2 years after the Civil Rights Act passage when your classroom integrated. Had there been much discussion? Had there been any frank, open, and honest accounting of what was about to happen?
Not among the children and not between children and adults. I overheard some things, particularly at church, when adults would talk to each other and I could eavesdrop on them. I understood that there was this thing called segregation that everybody approved of. I heard statements, one adult statement that really stuck in my head was that if God had intended for black people and white people to interact, he'd have made them the same color. And another statement was that, you know, black people want to hang out with their own kind just like white people want to hang out with our own kind, and that's the way the world ought to be. But in terms of preparation for what was going to happen after schools integrated or after the Civil Rights Act went into effect, no, I never really heard any discussion of that other than people complaining about it, white people complaining about it. Now, as soon as schools integrated, I heard a great deal of discussion about it because the presence of white kids and the black kids in the same classroom opened up the door to discussion among us.
So it started with these three black girls, and were they just delivered there, or did they just walk in? Was there no particular mention made of it, anything like that?
There was no preparation that I can recall at all, no. Mm-hmm. The principal simply walked them into our classroom. The way I describe it in the book is she sort of pretended they were new kids in town. And, of course, we all knew that nobody really moved to Jones County unless they really had to, and certainly not three new kids at a time. So there was a lot of pretense that we all knew what was going on and we all knew how to respond to it when, of course, that wasn't really true at all. Everybody was nervous about it. The teachers were nervous about it. The parents were upset. And when 2 years later the dual school systems were shut down and everybody had to go to the same school, of course, there was a huge reaction at that point. A lot of the white parents pulled their children out of public schools altogether and overnight founded private schools, most of them church-related private schools, to send their kids to so that they could make sure that their precious little white kid darlings were not tainted by the presence of black people. It was just that overt and, mm-hmm. and very unfriendly.
Jim Grimsley is our guest in The Exchange. His book is How I Shed My Skin, Unlearning the Racist Lessons of a Southern Childhood. Now, you had a unique way of breaking the ice with the three black girls in your class when the teacher was out of the room. Tell us about that.
Well, this was probably my worst moment as an 11-year-old. This happened close to the first day of school. One of the black girls sat behind me, and I thought it would be funny to call her a name, and I didn't think she would talk back to me, so I turned and I called her a black bitch, and she looked at me and blinked once and said, "And you're a white one, and what do you think about that?" And that was the moment when I understood there was something wrong in what I had been told about black kids, black people in general, because she wasn't supposed to be able to talk back to me. She was supposed to be my inferior. And here she was, sassy and loud and embarrassing me in front of my peers. And this was a moment when I realized that she just felt like another kid. And if I took the racial element out of the discussion, this was just the kind of dispute I would have had with anybody if I'd called them a name in class. So there was a duality that moment. There was realizing that I had this stuff in me that I didn't know what to do with, this racism. And then there was the realization that this black person who was sitting behind me was just a little 11-year-old like me.
How did you and Violet is the name you use for? You mentioned you changed a lot of names, but
right.
How did you and Violet get past that day?
Well, the next day she came into the classroom and she said, "Are you going to call me any black bitch again?" And I said, "Nope." And you know, we were stuck with each other as seat neighbors, so we just started talking. I mean, you have to remember, I was 11. We were kids, and we didn't have the attention span to really hate on each other, and I didn't really have the impulse for very long to hate on her. She was, you know, she was the person that I talked to complain about the teacher. I didn't like the teacher very much that year. And the other two girls in the class and I got to be very good friends. Violet and I never quite got to be real friends that year, but, you know, we knew each other for the rest of high school. And by the end of high school, we hadn't become close, but we knew we were on the same side.
Let's take some calls here. Let's go first to Gene in Winston. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Jim Grimsley, the author of How I Shed My Skin.
Yes, hello. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Well, I was born in Houston, Texas, in 1932 and brought up in that kind of environment. And but I wanted to recount two incidents that reveal to me my attitudes toward this racism, only I'm going to call it tribalism, and I'm not going to use the terms black and white because I've never seen anybody that's black and I've never seen anybody that's white. I think we're all of us are different colors. Some are more tan, some are more pinkish, and so on. Well, anyway, back, I guess it was in the 1950s, I found myself seated at a table with a young man who was a Negro, and he talked just like me. He didn't have that southern darky accent. And I realized, well, gosh, you know, the skin color doesn't matter, because with his speech I could tell he had a mind like mine. And then another incident that was even more revealing, I worked as a substitute teacher, and one day I went to a school which was mostly Negro. those kids all spoke with that, you know, southern darky accent. Well, there was a girl there who was blonde. She was obviously Caucasian and very fair. Well, listen, she had cleverly learned to speak in the same accent as her schoolmates. And when we talked, I realized, well, you may look Caucasian, but underneath you're not. You're really Negro. And I was just amazed at my emotional reaction. And I think we should use the word tribalism, which is instinctive, and I think skin color is only one of the, obviously with me, skin color was not the main thing. Obviously with me, the speech pattern was. So that's what I wanted to share.
All right, Gene, thanks for the recollection. Very much appreciate that. Jim, what do you make of that? You get your own experiences, too, with people being white but considered perhaps less than white or something.
Well, I think the way we have to understand that whiteness is a construction, that it is something that was created hundreds of years ago to justify enslaving black people. We created a white identity. And that whiteness is especially associated with the South. In the North, there's less tendency to talk about people in terms of white and black, and more of a tendency to talk about people in terms of nationality, and I think maybe tribe is not a bad way to think about that. The fact is, I mean, the Ta-Nehisi Coates book that came out last year talks about this, the dream, the people who dream that they're white. There's a sort of a fantasy that we have that we're, that our color makes us different and that our color really associates us. But I can, you know, when I was a child, when there was somebody of Latin American origin, there's a chapter in the book where I talk about somebody who had brown skin, but he wasn't a black person. He wasn't a Negro. And so he came to our school, but he was still dark enough that he made white people nervous. There's always been people who didn't fit into that definition of whiteness, but they were not Negroes, and so they had to be lumped in with white people if you reduced the world to black and white terms.
Jim Grimsley, again, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is How I Shed My Skin, Unlearning the Racist Lessons of a Southern Childhood. We've heard some other people share their experiences. Skeeter in Eugene, welcome back to the Exchange.
Good morning, Jeffrey.
Hi.
Thanks for a great show. I was a Navy brat, a military brat when I was a kid. And my parents, who had grown up in southern Maryland, would occasionally take us back to see the grandparents. And my mother's father was the president of the bank, and he was fairly rich, and had a maid, a black woman. Her name was Emma Smallwood, and her son, George Bernard Shaw Smallwood, was one of my best friends. I would hang out in the kitchen while they were making the meals. They were not able to really eat any of the food until we were all finished. And it was such a strange dichotomy to sit in the kitchen and chat with Emma and George. He was one of my best friends. And, you know, we would just be hanging out. And then I would have to go get dressed and sit down at a formal dinner while Emma and George would serve us. And they would have to wait until we were all finished before they could have their dinner. And in that small southern Maryland town, it was really segregated. It was a very obvious line that you could not cross. Mm-hmm. And it was a real strange experience to grow up like that. I'm glad I knew George.
All right. Thanks for that, Skeeter. Very much appreciate that. The way that the lines got drawn in our country never ceased to amaze me, Jim. And as you point out, having grown up a child of the South, this stuff wasn't questioned. It was just sort of an assumption that people with white skin were superior.
Right. It was not questioned. It wasn't overtly taught. It was something you were expected to figure out on your own. I mean, I've kind of joked in some discussions about the book that we didn't have white people's school from 3 to 4 in the afternoon or anything of that kind. What we had was a socialization process that taught us that white people and black people had to live separately. If they interacted, they had to interact with the kind of care that the listener just described. That notion that I had one lady get very disturbed when we were talking about the book, and she said, "Well, you know, we had a maid, but I don't think we were racist. We even built her a bathroom, our maid a bathroom,
an indoor bathroom."
Right, and I said, "Well, didn't you all have a bathroom that she could use?" And she said, "Well, no, of course she couldn't use our bathroom." And she didn't really hear herself. She didn't understand it. I think by the end of the conversation, it had become clear to her that she had basically answered her own question, that yes, indeed, she'd grown up with the same ideas that I had grown up with. I mean, it's a hard thing to say to yourself, I'm a racist, or that I was a racist, or however it is you construct that sentence in your head. But if you don't see the stuff that was raised, that was inculcated into you, then you're not going to do anything about it, and you're going to go on having that stuff in you subconsciously. It's much better to deal with this kind of stuff on a conscious level than it is to deal with it through the process of accident, basically.
The day one of the new girls brought an issue of Ebony to class, it sounds like your eyes got kind of big. Why did it rivet your attention so?
Because I had never seen pictures of black people in professional clothing, in suits and dresses. I mean, you have to understand, in those days, television was basically entirely white. I mean, nobody living now who doesn't remember it is going to have anything like that image in their head. But there was probably Bill Cosby on television, and he was the only black person I'd ever seen on television at that point, other than Amos and Andy, the other famous example that I can think of. But when I saw Ebony, what I saw was people who lived not just like me, but better than I did. I mean, my family was pretty poor. We didn't live in a very nice house. We were working class people. But what I saw was middle class and upper class black people, stars of music and would-be stars of television. I mean, the magazine was very slickly produced. It was obviously culturally important to the girls who brought it to school, but I'd never seen it or heard of it. And I frequented a drugstore and perused magazines all the time, but that store didn't carry Ebony.
And then you also mentioned the day that that there you were, the Baptist white boy, watching the girls perform a James Brown song. What created that moment, and what happened?
Well, there was a lot of back and forth talk in the classroom between the white students and those black girls. There was teasing. There was some name calling. In front of the teachers, there was never anything very drastic, but in we had a teacher who needed to leave the room to smoke quite a good deal, and so he left us alone in the classroom. And at one point, somebody said something to one of the girls about black skin, and all three of the girls got up and started dancing to the James Brown song "I'm Black and I'm Proud." It was as if they had choreographed the moment. They stood up, they started doing the song, they started the same dance steps. They were perfectly in time with one another. They did the dance. They looked at the rest of us in this defiant way, and then they sat down again. That was my first exposure to the notion of black proud, black pride. I mean, and it was quite a moment. You know, white kids just didn't do that kind of thing. We didn't. I was a Baptist. We weren't even supposed to dance at all.
Were there discussions that came out of that moment, though? I mean, because the girls would talk about the revolution coming and things like that.
Right. Yeah. They kept one of my friends, not Violet, but I think it was Ursula, used to tell me, "Don't worry, Jimmy. The revolution's coming, but we've got you on the list so that we won't kill you." The myth was that black people were keeping a list of the good white people and the bad white people, and she wanted me to know I was going to be on the good list. Again, we were 11 years old, so there wasn't a lot of real adult discussion.
Right.
That didn't happen until I got to high school.
Okay, much more to talk about again with Jim Grimsley. His book is How I Shed My Skin, Unlearning the Racist Lessons of a Southern Childhood. He grew up in Eastern North Carolina. We'll come back and hear more of his story. If you'd like to share your stories as well, join us on the Jefferson Exchange. Back with Jim Grimsley and you in a minute 20. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Jim Grimsley, known for his novels and shifting into nonfiction for a book about himself and his life as a white boy in Eastern North Carolina, and a racist one at that, he admits. His book is called How I Shed My Skin, Unlearning the Racist Lessons of a Southern Childhood, now out in paperback. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email jx@jeffnet.org. You skipped pretty quickly from the sixth grade to the seventh. Was the rest of the year pretty much uneventful with the three new girls in the room?
Yeah, pretty much so. The truth is, my memories of the 2 years blended so much it was hard to tell which was sixth grade and which was seventh grade. Because the classroom was so small, and we were actually sharing the same two teachers for at least for the sixth grade, and then the seventh grade teacher was one of the teachers who was with us in sixth grade. There was not a lot of confrontation between us in those years. The teachers kept pretty good control of the classroom.
Now, in seventh grade, you had a boy in a wheelchair in your class. How did he provoke discussion, if there was any?
He had a sign on his wheelchair that said, "I hate niggers." I mean, I would say the N-word, but that makes the moment sound too polite, because what he wanted to do was bring that nasty word into the classroom. The teacher saw the sign on the classroom. Now, this was an unhappy kid. He'd been wheelchair bound his whole life. He was openly racist. But he was also totally isolated in the class. He had a sister in the class with him, but he didn't really have friends, because he wasn't a person we paid much attention to. He'd never been with us before. He failed the grade before ours, and that's how he dropped down into our classroom. So what happened in this moment was the teachers ran his wheelchair down to the principal's office. They gave him a good talking to. The black kids just pretty much took the name-calling in stride, and nothing else was said in class. There was a good deal said outside of class. I didn't actually know this when I was in the class with them, but the girls were getting called a lot of names on the school buses coming to school. I didn't ride the school buses in those days because we lived in town and I just walked to school. But I've heard from Ursula and Rhonda and Violet that they had a hard time on the school buses. In fact, there was a day when one of the school buses actually acted as if it was going to run the two sisters. Ursula and Rhonda were sisters, and the bus swerved off the road and sort of aimed at them and scared them pretty well.
Yikes.
So that they ended up having the Justice Department come down to talk to them to see whether they needed to enforce any kind of legal protections for them at the time. There was nothing done as far as I know, but when I talked to Rhonda and Ursula, I realized just how brave they were in facing this day in and day out. Because at this point, there was nothing but token integration, so they were essentially going to white schools and facing down white children every day.
The incident with the boy in the wheelchair, you know, educators would probably call this a teachable moment today. Was it used for that in any way?
No. The teacher didn't say anything about it in the class.
That was that. We have an email here from Mike in Medford. He says, great discussion topic. When my 92-year-old grandmother from the Midwest was expecting a mixed-race granddaughter, she was so upset she didn't see her for weeks after she was born. When my sister finally brought her over, she must have cried for a week. Being very religious, she believed God had sent her a lifelong lesson to rethink her evil ways. She demanded my niece be brought over twice a day after that. People can change, even in their 90s, writes Mike in Medford.
Wow. That's a really great email. That's people can change, and that is the point that I'm trying to make. I've had a lot of people tell me that this would only change gradually, and it would change over the course of generations. And my answer to that has been that, well, I changed much more quickly than that. And anybody who looks in the mirror and sees this stuff inside them can change. And obviously this 90-year-old grandmother changed.
She did indeed. Deb and Talent wants to know if you found your friends for the book. You mentioned talking to Ursula and the other girls. So you have talked to them as adults?
Yes. In fact, one of the girls, Rhonda, was interviewed with me on NPR when the hardback came out last year. We had a great time talking on the radio. Hmm. I went back to Jones County and gave a reading, and there were a lot of my classmates and people who've gone to school with me there, including Violet. It was the first time I'd seen her since high school graduation. She was really excited about the book. In fact, she was sitting next to I was reading the chapter where I called her name to the crowd, and she was sitting next to my mom, and my mom says she kept going, well, you get to the good stuff, Jimmy, get to the good stuff. Because there's a fairly long introduction before you get to that scene, but she wanted me to get right there. She wanted that moment to shine. It was really special.
Was it a good reception overall when you brought it back to Jones County?
Yes, it was. Now, of course, the people who don't like what I've written wouldn't come out for an event like that. I have heard from a couple of them, and but nothing that was worth worrying about.
A couple of incidents I want to ask about here, which is Ursula at one point had kissed you on the cheek, which apparently was your first kiss. You say she knew she was not supposed to without asking, but I mean, was the not supposed to part reinforced to you or impressed upon you somehow?
It wasn't, and that was an issue that had nothing to do with race. You just weren't supposed to kiss other children. I mean, this was a conservative Southern school, and they didn't encourage, you know, bodily contact of any kind in the classroom, not holding hands, nothing. The fact that a black girl had kissed me, though, was one of the reasons that moment made me afraid, because I didn't know what the other kids in class would say about it, and I didn't know what so I told the teacher about it right away. I had kind of learned my lesson after calling Violet the name the year before. I just didn't want to. I wanted to be careful, and I wanted to forestall any kind of gossip about that moment. It was really a sweet moment. I mean, it was my first kiss, and it was Ursula's first kiss also, as she told me many years later. We just really liked each other,
you know, and I think
we might have had a little crush on each other if times had been different than they were. But we were also still, you know, I think we were 12 years old that year, so we weren't ready to date or anything.
Mm-hmm. Randy Roush says, maybe I missed the dates, but when are Mr. Grimsby's recollections taking place? This is the fall of 1966 when the girls first came into your classroom, right?
That's correct. Right. And the kiss would have been the spring of 1968, probably, which was the last year that schools were segregated in my county. The schools were desegregated county by county, court district by court district. It was there was not a uniform process throughout the South.
Did you even know where the black schools were when you grew up in Pollocksville?
I'm pretty sure I knew where the J.W. Willey School was because we passed it so often. The town was very small, and so the presence of a second school was pretty much notable. So I did know that that was the black school. But You know, and there was no attempt to hide it. There wasn't anywhere to hide it in a town that small.
Right. I'm still struck by the way that integration was handled. And you mentioned about the rise of the church-based private schools where a lot of the white kids went once the school system integrated. But you mentioned that the school district really couldn't afford to run two separate districts. But how suddenly did the white schools crop up, the white private schools, upon integration? Was it like, you know, that year?
It was over the course of the summer, as a matter of fact. The Supreme Court handed down a ruling saying unequivocally that freedom of choice programs, token integration programs, like the one in operation in Jones County, were not sufficient, and that schools had to do something about that. And so this came down in May. By sometime in July or August, I got the word that from my parents, that we would be going to school, that schools would be completely integrated in the fall. And so over the course of that summer, the white parents who did not want to send their children to school with a lot of black kids, they had accepted token integration, but when it became full integration, they rebelled and they formed a private school over the course of about 3 months. And these were people, as I said in the book, that wouldn't spend a nickel on anything if they didn't have to. Mm-hmm. I mean, everybody in Jones County, even if they had money, they acted poor. They complained about being poor all the time. So it was sort of a culture of pretending poverty and actually being poor. But somehow these people found the money to open a private school. And not just there in our little town, but in every town all over the eastern North Carolina.
Wow.
And most of them were associated with churches, so the church funding was tapped to help some of these schools. So it was astonishing to see. I'd never seen so much change happen so fast there.
Let's take another call. We have Connie and Eugene on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Jim Grimsley, who wrote How I Shed My Skin.
Good morning. It's wonderful to hear such an honest retelling of your youth. I am 65, and I noticed over the last 5 to 10 years that I bicycle a lot, and I'll be pedaling along. All of a sudden, in my case, ethnic slur would come out of my head, and I thought, this is peculiar. And I realized they were the comments my mother used to make as she was driving in the 50s and 60s, and I'd be sitting next to her. She'd make comments about various ethnic groups.
Yeah.
My dad was very egalitarian, and he was an amateur historian, and she would never make those comments at home, but when we were driving then, and I asked one time, I went to a lecture on perception and aging, and he said that as we age, the barriers we've created to stop something like, you know, using the N-word or any other negative that we've learned to stop using gradually fade away, or our ability to stop these negative comments fades away as we age. And I found it interesting that I am remembering as I age more from what I encountered with my mother and others in our Midwestern area. And so I wondered if things had come back to you as you've gotten older that you hadn't even considered or thought about or put in the back of your brain.
All right, yeah. Thanks, Connie.
Unfortunately, yeah. I mean, I have to say I was blaming it on writing this book. I thought the book was stirring up some of that old language in my head. But, you know, I have noticed that a lot of my friends, especially friends who in high school were very liberal, they were aggressively participating in the integration that was happening. You know, there was a group of us kids in high school who mixed with black and white together really, really aggressively. But I know some of those friends have become very conservative in their older years. And I've noticed members of my family, you know, falling back into some of the old patterns. Also, that was one of the impulses I had in writing the book, was to examine where that all was coming from. So it's good to know there's some scientific basis for it. It's not all that comforting,
right,
but it is of some comfort.
Jim, you write that in another time in that place where you grew up, lynchings and similar atrocities would have involved people like you. How close did you come to any events like those in your time in Jones County?
Well, the last lynching that was held in Jones County was in the mid-30s, as I recall, and that was one of the last that was held in North Carolina. So I have friends whose parents remember attending a lynching in Trenton, which is the county seat there. And so that's plus I have family members, cousins who were active in the Klan when all this was going on in the book during the 60s when the Klan had a resurgence. So I expect I came fairly close. I would not be surprised to learn that my father was involved in cross burnings or you know, violence against black people in our locale. He was not somebody, my father was unfortunately someone I didn't know very well. He wasn't a very communicative man, and he and my mother had a very turbulent marriage, so they ended up divorcing while I was in high school. But yeah, if it were not for my own reaction to meeting these black kids and figuring out who they were, I don't know that I wouldn't have done the same thing myself.
Well, you learned a lot over time, and it's great to read about it in How I Shed My Skin, Unlearning the Racist Lessons of a Southern Childhood, now out in paperback. Jim Grimsley wrote it and joined us today in the exchange. Jim, thank you so much.
Thank you, Jeff. It was really a pleasure to be.